This is the Mason Vera Payne Show, your go-to lifestyle program, covering everything from technology and gaming to movies, TV shows, and pop culture to the supernatural and beyond. Brought to you by WGNRadio.com with your host, the unabridged millennial, Mason Vera Payne.
Mason Payne here, live from the MVP Studios in Chicago, and thank you for tuning in. When I was younger, I remember the video game console wars. There was Nintendo, TurboGrafx-16, Atari Jaguar, and even Sega Genesis. Now, Sega was the first to offer many features such as online gaming, backwards compatibility, and even streaming. Things that are successful in today's market, but, you know, why didn't it work out for Sega in the past? So to explain to me why is National Video Game Museum Director Sean Kelly. Thanks for joining me, Sean.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
Could you tell me a little bit about Sega Genesis?
Well, Sega Genesis or Sega itself, Genesis was their 6-bit console, their 16-bit console. It came out after the Sega Master System. Probably their most successful console. Sega was actually started in the late 40s. It was they were distributing slot machines on military bases in Hawaii. They eventually became a company called Service Games because the name came from their dealing with service personnel until 1951, when slot machines were outlawed. When slot machines were outlawed, they were kind of screwed. They didn't know what they were going to do, so they moved all of their operations to Japan. And their history is kind of long. It's kind of complicated, and there were a couple of mergers, but eventually the name Sega came from the two words service games. In 1966, Sega actually released their very first game, an arcade game called Periscope, and from there it just kind of snowballed.
Oh, wow. I didn't even know that. So it's an acronym, service games?
Yeah. Well, no, it's not an acronym. It's a combination of two words. And I actually had to look this up because I didn't know the word for it either, but the word for it is a portmanteau, when you combine two words to make one. So, yeah, it's interesting. I quite honestly knew that they started as a U.S. company, and I was doing a little bit of research on it, and I did not know where the word Sega came from, though. I found that really interesting, too.
Now, during the 16-bit era, you know, the market was a little bit flooded almost with all these devices, and the only ones I can think of off the top of my head were TurboGrafx-16 and Super Nintendo and all that, but did Genesis really do that well against their competitors?
You know, the Genesis did great, and I'm a bit of an old timer. I grew up during the Atari 2600 and the Intellivision era, and I was there as, you know, as the video game industry was kind of born. But even as an old timer, the 16-bit era was a blast. It was really a lot of fun to live through that, because really there were only two players, the Super NES and the Sega Genesis. There was the TurboGrafx-16, the third competitor, but it was kind of a distant third place to the two big guys, Sega and Nintendo. And the fun part is that Sega and Nintendo, the systems were pretty comparable. You know, the Genesis said it was faster, and the Super Nintendo said it was more colorful and had better sound. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know the answers to those questions, to be perfectly honest. Maybe the Genesis was a little faster, and if some really, really techno geek wanted to break it all down to every gigahertz or megahertz, they could probably tell me that one was better than the other. But they were both pretty comparable, and they were both they both had some great games, so it was really fun to live through that 16-bit era. And like I said, that was probably the best time in gaming for me, because, you know, both those systems were really competitive with each other, and they were pushing each other to do better games. And really, the ones that reaped the rewards were the players, because there were some great games to play on both of those systems.
Yeah, I remember the TurboGrafx, like, in my mind as a kid, that was the one I could never have because it was too expensive. And my father, he ended up getting me the Sega Genesis.
NEC didn't really try to compete with them price-wise. They kind of did their own thing. And the TurboGrafx also had by far the best handheld version, called the Turbo Express. And the Turbo Express had an amazing screen. It was for its time. You know, I mean, today you hold a Nintendo Switch in your hand and it's high definition and 1080 and everything else. But first time, the Turbo Express was amazing. And the Turbo Express just played the regular TurboGrafx games. So you had the Turbo Express, you had the Turbo CD, and you had the TurboGrafx. But they were kind of doing their own thing. You know, they were, here we are, this is what we are, like it or not. We're not, you know, they wanted to compete with Sega and Nintendo, but they never did. They were never really a threat to either of them, but they had their own cool stuff. So it was interesting.
Yeah, that's so true. I know with TurboGrafx, like with Bonk's Adventures, I think everybody, Super Nintendo and Genesis, they kind of made their own little clone version of it. And I can't think of it off the top of my head, but I know that they made their own version of Bonk's Adventures. And, you know, they tried to, I think, just kind of steal the idea in a way, just to have their own version of it. But when it comes to that, I know that a lot of times consoles, they started making their own add-ons. TurboGrafx had their CD add-on. Sega Genesis had theirs. I know Nintendo never had one. But in the case of Sega, they also had like their own cartridge was the 32X. What was the big deal about that thing?
The 32X was a device that plugged into the top of the Sega Genesis into the cartridge port, and then it had its own cartridge port. So you plug this thing into your Sega Genesis, and then you plug special 32X cartridges into the 32X, and they would play on your TV, and the Genesis would kind of be using the 32X to add some graphics to it to make them a little bit more detailed. What it was the real story was that the Sega Saturn was supposed to be coming out, and Sega was worried that the Saturn wasn't going to make it by, I think it was 1994 that they were trying to get it out by, and they were worried that it wasn't going to make it. So you got to remember now, this is just out of the 16-bit era and you know, the intense competition between Nintendo and Sega. So everybody was trying to, you know, rush and not let the other guy beat them. So Sega was worried that Nintendo had something up their sleeves, and they did. You know, they were working on a CD add-on as well. But everybody was trying to beat the next guy. So when Sega was, like I said, Sega was worried that the Saturn wasn't going to make it, they developed this this 32X. And quite honestly, in my opinion, the 32X was the first nail in Sega's coffin, so to speak, in terms of game console manufacturing, because it didn't do well. It really kind of made people mad, and the games weren't that much better than the Sega Genesis, and you know, people kind of were starting to get a bad taste in their mouth from Sega at the time of the 32X.
Yeah, that's true. I remember it was one of those add-ons where you're like, oh, you need to have it if you want to play it better, and it was like, well, you know, then why did I buy this console to begin with? Shouldn't it already be inside of it? Like, I can understand right. The CD add-on portion, but for a cartridge, that was a very sour taste in my mouth as a kid. Because it's hard to convince your parents, you know, to separate with $50 at the time. So.
It was actually, the 32X was released at $150. It was a lot of money.
Yeah, in the 90s, yes, that was a shit ton of money. And actually, I think that's still a lot of money now.
Yeah, exactly, still. I mean, but imagine how much more in the 90s. My parents weren't, well, I was old enough to buy it for myself, but even at that time, I wasn't laying out the cash for it.
Now, when it came to the Sega CD, how far apart was Sega Saturn from Sega CD? Like, how many years?
Sega CD, I think, was 92 or 93, and the Saturn was 94.
Oh,
the Saturn actually did make it in 94. And that's the thing about all of this history of Sega, is everything was going so fast at that time. Everything was moving forward so quickly. Perfect example of why the 32X was such a bad idea. I mean, the Saturn was right behind it. I mean, I don't even think it was a year later when the Saturn was released. And the Sega CD was, everybody saw that CD-based games were the future of gaming. Everybody could see it. Nintendo, Sony, everybody, even Sega as well. Everybody knew that CDs, they had way more storage than you could put data on a cartridge. They were cheaper to manufacture. Everybody knew that was the way they were going. And everybody wanted to jump on that, you know, next generation technology bandwagon, so to speak. The Sega CD was decent. There are some decent games for it. There's a respectable library. But just in terms of how long the market was for the lifespan for the Sega CD, it just never really had any time to pick up too much speed. I mean, it was canceled in I think it was 1996, so it was around for 3 or 4 years, but it never really had that much of a chance to catch on. But it wasn't its fault, and it honestly wasn't even Sega's fault, because like I said, the technology is advancing so fast. It, like, Saturn is out in late 94, early 95, so there wasn't a whole heck of a lot of time.
And not just that, but in 94 also Sony PlayStation came out, and that dominated the market. I'll be honest, I don't even remember one title for Sega Saturn, and I think, how horrible is that? Because I remember as a kid, I exclusively played on PlayStation, and that was like the future of it. And then PlayStation 2 came out, and I never even looked at any other console because that played DVDs.
Well, that's the thing. If you think about the way that the timeline works, is the PlayStation came out in 1994, and in 1994, people are already a little annoyed with Sega at that time. Nintendo had promised a CD add-on for the Super Nintendo, and eventually they didn't produce one. It was actually interesting. It was a collaboration between Nintendo and Sony, where Sony was supposed to make an add-on for the Super Nintendo that was going to let you play CD-based games on the Super Nintendo, and Nintendo and Sony kind of went back and forth, and promises were made and promises were broken. And what happened was, Nintendo said, "Yeah, you know what? We're not going to do CDs at all. We're gonna do cartridges in our next system, which was the Nintendo 64." and the Sony guy said, "Well, we developed all this technology for you. Why don't we just put out our own system then?" And that's what they did. They put out the PlayStation 1. PlayStation 1 came out, like I said, at a time where Nintendo wasn't jumping on the CD bandwagon, so to speak. Sega had already kind of piss people off a little bit with the 32X and even the Saturn. So now you got this new guy on the block. Sony puts out the PlayStation, and everybody's kind of hungry for somebody new, or a new player, so to speak, in the game. So the PlayStation just took off.
Yeah, and I remember in 98, I think it was 98, Dreamcast came out, and I thought like, oh man, Dreamcast was the next big thing. It was going to finally redeem itself after all these years of failed CD products, because it actually had the internet capabilities to it. How come that one didn't do well?
The Dreamcast actually had a very strategic release date. It was released in 9/9/99. So September 9th of 1999 was the Dreamcast. The Dreamcast, I'll tell you what, the Dreamcast really got a bad rap, in my opinion. The Dreamcast, it's a great little system. It's very capable, very powerful for its time. A couple of problems with the Dreamcast is, first of all, people had, at that time, people already had, like I said, they already had a kind of a bad taste in their mouth from Sega. The people that had laid out $150 for their 32X and didn't get much out of it, the Saturn was canceled in only 3 years. So even if you did get a Saturn, it was gone before you blinked your eyes anyway. So now, Sega's got a new system coming out, the Dreamcast, and most people were done with Sega at that point. And it's sad because, if you look at the Dreamcast library, you play some of the games, even the controllers were good. It actually had a pretty decent library of games. It played well. It was relatively easy to program for developers. And like you say, it was the first system to offer, online gaming built in. Yet it didn't do well at all. And my opinion is the only reason why it didn't do well is the company behind it. And not that they did anything wrong with the Dreamcast itself, but the problem was that people were pretty fed up with Sega at that point.
Now, a lot of things, one of the things I remember about Sega that many people don't remember is the Sega Channel. Now, I don't remember what year it came out or between what console, but, they were doing a lot of innovative stuff. They were trying to put their hat in every ring. And eventually, they kind of just stopped making consoles. I mean, why, other than the bad taste, a couple of bad decisions, but, I mean, they were still, it's Sega, everybody knows what Sega is. Why would they just take their hat out of the ring?
Well, a couple of things. The Sega Channel, we could talk about that a little bit. The Sega Channel actually plugged into the top of the Sega Genesis, and it connected to your cable TV line. So what would happen is you would pay a service fee, and I think it was around 15 or 20 bucks a month at the time, which, it's not a lot of money. But, again, this was 1994, so it's $15 a month, talking your parents into $15 a month in 1994 wasn't as easy as it might be today. I mean, Xbox Live, even today, playing, you know, connecting to Xbox Live or the PlayStation Network is about $5 a month. So 1994, you're looking for $15 a month. It's kind of a lot of money. But the so what happened is you paid us $15 a month, and they delivered games to your system. There were about 30 to 40 games available at any given time. They would mix up the rate, you know, the mix of games every so often. And, you know, you can play regular games as long as you want, as long as you didn't turn the system off, because there was no memory, there was no, like, battery backup or anything like that. Whatever you downloaded to your system, once you turned it off, it was gone, and you have to download it again. But it wasn't a bad idea. The only thing about it is it also wasn't the first. So that had been done already.
Really?
It was on the Mattel and Television system in, I think it was 1983, a system called the Play Cable was out. The Play Cable did exactly the same thing. It connected your cable TV and it sent television games to your Intellivision system. And then the Atari 2600 had something called the Game Line Master Module or Master Modem, maybe it was. But anyway, it was a modem that plugged into the Atari 2600 and it connected to your phone line, and you would download games over your phone line. So the Sega Channel was good. The problem with the Sega Channel, it was released in 1994. So if you think about a couple of things that we've talked about that have happened in 1994, first, the 32X came out. Second, the Saturn has been promised and is almost out. Saturn's on its way. So they released the Sega Channel add-on for a system that was basically over with. The successor was already out. So not a bad idea, just the execution of that. The Sega Channel had come out maybe two or three years earlier, when the Genesis was still, you know, the top of the hill with the Super Nintendo. It could have had a very different future. But it was just the timing as far as the Sega Channel is concerned. I know there was another part of this question, and now I'm forgetting it, but.
Well, you know, actually, like, after you talked about that, I was like, Jesus, 94 was a hell of a year for consoles.
Right? There's so much going on. And you know, it good and bad. You know, it's not all good. There's a lot going on. You got you know, cool peripherals coming out for your Genesis. You got the successor coming out. But, you know, again, as far as we're kind of limiting ourselves to what's going on with Sega at this time, but there's a lot going on, and like I said, it's not all good. People are getting a little annoyed with what's going on. So this is, you know, like I said, the start of the end of Sega, so to speak. So Sega, the other part of the question is why did Sega stop manufacturing consoles?
Yeah.
Well, if you think about the Dreamcast, like I said, the Dreamcast came out and it got a pretty bad rap. People were pretty sick of Sega at that time, and you know, all the shenanigans that were going on there. Sega kind of saw it. I mean, I don't know if they didn't have the dough to keep going, but the Dreamcast was powerful, and even it didn't do well. So it was kind of like, it was discontinued in 2001. So 2001, it came out in 99, so it was only around for about 2 years, but Sega pulled the plug on it. The problem may have been money, or the problem may have been that they just saw the writing on the wall that they were going to, you know, they were going to get their butts kicked. But the third problem is PlayStation 2 was coming out. You know, PlayStation 1 was dominating. Dreamcast was more powerful than PlayStation 1, and that's, you know, they thought, oh, cool, we're better, we'll be the top. But PlayStation 2, I think, came out in 2000, so there wasn't very much time for the Dreamcast to even get a following or gain a following. PlayStation 2, if you remember, PlayStation 2 not only plays PlayStation 2 games, but it could also play all the PlayStation 1 games. So Sony's got this new console coming out that has a library of over 1,000 PlayStation 1 games that it can play, and all of the new stuff, and the PlayStation 2 is more powerful than the Dreamcast. So Sega was just like, you know what, we're done. We can't compete with you guys. And quite honestly, from a business standpoint, if you look at it, it is probably a pretty smart decision on their part, because they weren't going to beat Sony. They were going to lose. And now Microsoft is coming out with their own console. The Xbox is coming out. So they probably would have been out of business if they kept manufacturing Dreamcast.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Xbox came out and it didn't do well. I don't think it did that well, but it was Microsoft, and I think they just kept throwing money into that bottomless pit until it did well.
Right. Microsoft has more money than God, so they can, you know, they can afford it. Sega certainly didn't. Sega was kind of just kind of getting by. So they discontinued the Dreamcast in 2001, and at that point they said, you know what, let's just make games. So the games side of Sega, it did okay, and they're still making games. The only problem with their games is that two things. Sega doesn't have that, you know, I don't want to say marquee character, because they do have Sonic the Hedgehog, and there are some great Sonic games that have come out. But Sonic isn't a sure thing like Mario is with Nintendo. You can look at pretty much any Mario game that Nintendo puts out, and if Mario's in that game, you can pretty much bet your $60 that it's going to be a good game. And that hasn't always been the case with the Sonic games. There have been Sonic games that aren't as great. I mean, there are some great Sonic games, but it's not a sure thing with Sonic. So Sega doesn't have that reputation with the marquee character that Nintendo does. The other problem with Sega as being a software developer is they went from a huge company, a multinational company with offices in Japan and Europe and the U.S., to just one that was making games. So you have this huge company, and all of a sudden now, we don't need all of this overhead. We don't need all of these people. We need to downsize so that we're just developing software. and they didn't. It took them way too long to get to a small kind of compact size to just make some games and make decent games. And they didn't. They were just way too big to be a software-only company, and they were losing money. I think now they're down to the point where, you know, if they can put out a few good games a year, that they would be successful. But at that time, it took them way too long to get to this point.
You know, I was going to ask, do you ever think that they're going to make a console? But after that, I don't think they're ever going to go back into the console game.
No, definitely not. They don't have the money. You know, that's the bottom line, is they just don't have the money. And I think it's unfortunate, too, because quite honestly, if you look back at it now, people have a lot of nostalgia or a lot of, good feelings, particularly towards the Dreamcast and the Sega Genesis. So if you look at, like, collectors today, everybody remembers the Dreamcast. Nobody bought it, but everybody remembers it. So it's one of those systems that people have, you know, oh, I remember that, I never ended up getting one. Well, you're the reason that Sega didn't do so well, you and, you know, 100 million other guys. But people always look back at the Dreamcast and they say, yeah, you know, that was a good system. And from a collectible standpoint, even a playable standpoint, people like to pick up the Dreamcast and play some of its games. You can play Dreamcast games today, and they're still, you know, they're still decent games. You know, I, like I said, a lot of what I've been saying about Sega has to do with the fact that I think people were a little annoyed at Sega in the mid '90s, and that never went away. And the thing about it is, it's gone now. So could Sega make another console? No, I don't think they could, because they don't have the money. But if they made like a little niche console, like a Dreamcast 2 or something like that, that played, like, say it played all the Dreamcast games and all the Sega Genesis games and maybe some new content, could that do well in a niche market? It could. I really believe it could, but I don't think Sega ever would do it, and I don't think Sega even could do it if they wanted to, because they don't have the money.
Yeah, one of the things I love about Sega Genesis is that if you're just beginning to start collecting old games, that's one of the consoles that you should do, because I think that it's only like 150-ish kind of games were made for it. So it's like a reasonable amount of games you could probably get for it, and at a good price, versus like a TurboGrafx, where each game is almost like a brand new game, $70.
You're right about the price, but actually there are over 700 games.
700
for the Sega Genesis. Yeah,
oh my God.
Yeah, we have a complete collection in the museum, in Texas. We have every one of them there, but there's over 700 games made for it. And, you know, that's the thing about the Genesis. There's a lot of good games on the Genesis, and there's a lot of variety on the Genesis. It's really really a great system and a great library. I have some, like I said, some of the most fond memories of any video game system are for the Sega Genesis.
Could you tell me a little bit about the museum?
Sure. Museum we opened just over a year ago in April of 2016. It was founded by myself. I'm Sean Kelly, my partner Joe Santulli, and my third partner John Hardy. Between the three of us, we have by far the largest collection in the world of video game hardware, software, paperwork, memorabilia, anything to do with video games. We've collected over the past 30 years, and we have the biggest collection. We started showing off our collection at a show that we hosted in Las Vegas in 1999 called Classic Gaming Expo. We did that show until 2014. And that show, every year, the biggest part of that show is, you know, we would have a lot of, you know, vendors selling vintage gaming things, and we would bring together each year about 100 former programmers and, like Atari guys. We had Nolan Bushnell, the founder of Atari. We had him at our show 1 year giving a speech. We had Steve Wozniak, the founder of Apple, at our show 1 year giving a speech. We would bring together, like I said, about 100 of the former programmers, and then we would put together what we would call the museum. So the museum was just basically a showcase for our collection, and we did that, like I said, from 1999 to 2014. But every year we did that show, people were like, come on, you guys got to, you know, find a place where we can see this stuff all year round. We don't want to just come to Las Vegas once a year and see this this awesome collection. So in 2009, we decided we put together a 501c3 nonprofit with the hopes of eventually finding a permanent home for our collection. And we did. In 2014, we were introduced to the folks at in Frisco, Texas, and they loved us, and we loved them, and they found us a place, and here we are. The museum is open now, and it's doing great.
Now, when it comes to the museum, is there a specific part that you love? Like, is there one that everybody has to go to?
You know, I'll tell you what. My favorite part of the collecting or of the collection is the memorabilia. I love the little knickknacks. Like we have a collection of buttons. You know, like at E3 every year, if you go to E3 and you go to the booth, they usually give you some sort of a little piece of a knickknack with a memorabilia for a game or for the company or something. And we have a pretty large collection of that stuff. And that stuff's my favorite because you always find something that you didn't even know existed. A friend of ours, a really good friend of ours, actually is David Crane, and he wrote the original Pitfall for the Atari 2600. He's one of the original founders of Activision. And every once in a while, we see David a couple times a year at various functions. And every once in a while, David will whip out something I just found this in my desk at home. And it's amazing. He always finds something that we never knew, some weird little trinket. But last thing he gave us was this like a visor that you would wear on your head. And this visor was made of leather, and it had, and David, before founding Activision, he worked at Atari, but this really heavy leather visor with the Atari logo, like, wow, embossed into the visor. Like, dude, where did you get this? I mean, we've been collecting this stuff for 30 years. We've never even seen a picture of one of these yet. Here he has one. That's my favorite part. I love the memorabilia. We have tons of it on display in the museum. But since we're talking about Sega, a couple of the more interesting Sega things that we have in the museum on display. We have a Sega Pluto. The Pluto was never released. So the Pluto was an unreleased version of the Sega Saturn, but had a modem built in for online play. So this is pre-Dreamcast, and they were already working on online play in the Saturn. Now, this never came out. It wasn't unreleased. It wasn't released. The Saturn was canceled before they ever actually released the system. But we do have a prototype of the Sega Pluto in the museum. We also have the Sega Neptune. Clearly Sega had a thing with planets.
Yeah, right.
But, Yeah, we also have a Sega Neptune. The Sega Neptune was going to be a Sega Genesis with 32X hardware built into it. So it was about the size of a Sega Genesis 2, a little bit wider, but about the size of a Sega Genesis Model 2, but it had the 32X built inside of it. The one that we have in the museum is the only one that's ever been found. It's the only one in the world. It doesn't work, but it's cool nonetheless. If you think about it, after just the conversation that we just had, people hated the Dreamcast. People were done with the Genesis at that point. Why would they make up a system that had the Genesis and the 32X built into one? But they did. And one last item that that comes to mind as far as the cool Sega stuff is we have what's called the Diver's Dreamcast in the museum. And Diver Dreamcast was actually offered for sale, but what it was is it kind of looked like one of those old iron diver's suits, you know, that you would get in and dive under the ocean.
Yeah.
It looks like the helmet of one of those. So inside this helmet is a TV, and it has a Dreamcast built into it. So it's a self-contained TV with a Dreamcast in it, and it's called the Diver's Dreamcast. We have one of those on display in the museum, too. They were released. They're certainly not easy to find, but they definitely were sold for a short time.
Well, thanks so much for coming on, Sean. I mean, you just have so much information. I think we just touched the tip of the iceberg with this.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun talking about it again.
For those listening, Sean Kelly also has his own store called Video Games Then and Now. It's at 4351 North Harlem Avenue in Norridge, Illinois.
This has been the Mason Vera Payne Show. Thanks for listening. Can't wait to hear more? Subscribe, rate, and comment at masonverapaine.com. That's masonverapaine.com. Also, follow Mason on Facebook and Twitter at Mason Vera Payne. That's all one word. And don't forget to share the show with your friends.